to experience, Jackson Snyder presents. We will examine the life of our master Yeshua by discovering his ancestors, family, and friends, by reviewing rare ancient manuscripts, and speaking to those who know him best. From the Vero Essene Yahad, now experience, Jackson Snyder presents. Start out today with an English translation of a very esoteric text right after the Kol Shofar. Yeah, we should call that the Kol Shofar. Kol means voice. Q-O-L. You were laughing?
Yes, he's laughing.
He looks like a barber tonight. He's got a stole on. All right, that's Lee. Lee's here. Susan's here. We're sitting around drinking red tea. I don't know what it is, but it sure calms you down. This is a very old text, comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls, called the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice. The Dead Sea Scrolls would have contained, had we had all of them, 52 Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice. Shirot Olad HaShabbat, because there are exactly 52 Sabbaths in every year in accordance with the Zadokite calendar. This particular text was translated by my old teacher, as a matter of fact, Carol Newsom, who is right now the president of the Scrolls Committee, and the number is 4Q-Serek-Serot, Olad HaShabbat. And it goes like this, just being one of them. By the instructor, song of the sacrifice of the seventh Sabbath of the 16th of the month. Praise the Elohim of the lofty heights, O you lofty ones among all the Elim of knowledge. Elim evidently is another way of expressing the plural of El. Let the holiest of the Elohim sanctify the King of Glory, who sanctifies by holiness all his holy ones. O you chiefs of the praises of all the Elohim, praise the splendidly praiseworthy Elohim with a big E. For in the splendor of praise is the glory of his realm. From it comes the praises of all. The Elohim, together with the splendor of all, his majesty, and exalt his exaltedness to exalted heavens. You most godlike ones of the lofty Elim, and exalt his glorious divinity above all the lofty heights. For he is Elohim of Elohim, and all the chiefs of the heights of heaven, and king of kings, of all the eternal councils. By the intention of his knowledge, at the words of his mouth come into being all the lofty angels. At the utterance of his lips, all the eternal spirits, by the intention of his knowledge, all his creatures in their undertakings, sing with joy, you who rejoice in his knowledge with rejoicing among the wondrous godlike beings, and chant his glory with the tongue of all who chant with knowledge, and chant his wonderful songs of joy with the mouth of all who chant for him. For he is Elohim of all who rejoice in knowledge forever and judge in his power all of the spirits of understanding. All right. Understand that these songs of the Sabbath sacrifice were used by the later Zadokite priesthood in their Sabbath worship, but also understand what's all going on here. Like everybody, I thought it was an assassination attempt. All right, in the trunk. But not only the men and women of the Ahad worshipped, But the angels came down from the various heights of the astronomical heavens to worship with them. These songs of the Sabbath sacrifice were meant not just for human beings to worship, but for humans and angels, Malachim and thrones, Elohim and God-like beings, to all come together in a dynastic praise event that included all good creatures of the universe. Now that's what their Shabbats were like. They believed fully that these mighty ones, these Malachim, were right there with them, worshiping with the same words. And who knows, they might have been there. This is one of the most mystical texts of the entire Qumran corpus, and though we just have a little bit of it, the very idea that they were involved with angelic entities and other entities of the spirit worshiping with them gives us an idea that they were a very, very mystical society. This being just one fragment of what must have been a very huge scroll, they had 52 different ones. The Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, also known as the Angelic Liturgy, is a liturgical work composed of 13 separate sections, one for each of the first 13 Sabbaths of the year. The songs evoke angelic praise and elaborate on angelic priesthood, the heavenly temple, and the Shabbat worship in that temple. The headings of the various songs may reflect the solar calendar. Although the songs bear no explicit indication of their source, the phraseology and terminology of the texts are very similar to those of other Qumran works. Maybe the angels wrote these. Who knows? 8 manuscripts of this work were found in Qumran Cave 4, and one in Cave 11, dating from the late Hasmonean and Herodian periods. That would be somewhere around, the late Hasmonean would be somewhere around 100 BC, and the Herodian period would be about the turn of the century, in the first century. One manuscript of the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, listen to this, was found at Masada, the Zealot Fortress. One of these texts was there. I wonder who would have brought that in. Anyway, we had the opportunity just very shortly to have a little bit of this worship raised for us. And the mention of the heavenly temple brings us back to Ezekiel's temple. And the temple in the temple scroll, or the temple scroll in the Dead Sea Scrolls. These two temples that we consider future are almost exactly identical. In Ezekiel, the canonical prophetic work, and in the temple scroll, almost exactly the same. But that's not all. As I mentioned last time, these temples are almost exactly the same as the ruins of a temple found in Amarna, Egypt, including the outbuildings that are reckoned in Ezekiel or found in Amarna. Now, you might have heard the name of the place Amarna before. Amarna was the capital of Egypt for a scant 17 or so years, when a special king came on the throne who was known as Amenhotep the Fourth. Amenhotep the Fourth. Of course, he was, before him was his father, Amenhotep the Third. Amenhotep the Third was a secret monotheist. Secret. He allowed the worship of the many pantheons of Egypt, all the gods of not only their own history, but of all the nations. All gods could be worshipped, but Amenhotep III, he worshipped quietly in his own chapels with his own family, the one Elohim. The one Elohim that he had learned about from a particular guy, a foreigner. Let's see if I can find his name again, because I can't remember. A foreigner named... Oh, golly, now I've lost that. I've got to tell you the name. It's important. Look at my little book. Panahisi. Panahisi was the viceroy, the top man under this pharaoh, Amenhotep IV. What does this have to do with anything? Well, we're talking about 1300 BC, if that gives you a little clue, where there was a monotheistic emperor on the throne, and bucking the religion of the time, throwing over the old gods, destroying their temples, their effigies, destroying their statues, and instead making a gigantic new capital city with a gigantic new temple, and a temple that was not only enclosed and exactly in the same dimensions and outbuildings as the Ezekiel and Temple Scroll temple, but also a temple that extended out into the land outside in a particular shape. So the people could worship as well, not inside the temple, they weren't allowed in there, but the people were lined up and shaped almost like a group of sports fans when they come together to do cheers and so forth. All the people that were on board with the worship of the one God came to the back of the temple and arranged themselves during the services. And most of those people that were back there were Hebrews. This in 1300 BC. This particular king, he changed his name from Amenhotep IV to Akhenaten. We talked a little about him last time. Akhenaten. All right. Akhenaten means servant of the Aten. Oh, a funny word comes into Hebrew from this period and from Egypt, and that is the word Adon. Adon. It's translated variously in the Old Testament. One way is as Lord or Master. It's also translated as Baal. You know, Baal means Lord. Adonai means my Baal or my Lord. Used as a cover-up for the sacred name by the Jews from the earliest times until today. And here we have a Pharaoh named Akhenaten, the servant of Aten. The Aten was the sun. Now, he wasn't a servant of the sun itself, but what the sun represented in this very strange Egypt that we had at that time for just 17 or 12 years. That sun was a representative of the great High El Elyon, who created the sun and sent the rays of the sun to bless all people. And what little bit of art is left from this particular period, because once Akhenaten the king died, the servant of Aten, the old priests came back, scattered the Hebrews, and tore down everything that Akhenaten had built and went back to the old gods, because there was money in those gods. That scared me. So I put on Facebook a picture of Akhenaten from one of his statues, and somebody else on there, I don't know if you saw him or not, on Barryard. I know, it's very distracting. You on, David? Okay. No, he gets cut off all the time. And we have Obama dressed up as Akhenaten. Now, this Akhenaten was pretty strange. He was the first pharaoh that ever came along that made effigies of himself the way he really looked. He had a very elongated face and an elongated skull. He was almost feminine in his statues, a flabby belly, pigeon-chested, yet he was married to a pretty familiar name, Nefertiti, the most beautiful woman that ever lived in Egypt. Akhenaten and Nefertiti, they were like the Kennedys in Camelot. They're building their own new empire based on a new religion and a new understanding of the sun. There were Hebrews there that picked up on that name, Aten, and it came into the language and is still in that language and is used by the Jews in their worship service. That is Adonai, master or Lord, is what it means. Nefertiti, the most beautiful woman in the world, had children, of course. One of those children was named Tutankhamun, that is King Tut. You probably heard of the curse of King Tut. When his tomb was found, those who found it and broke into it all died within 2 years, all of them. So there was something special about this bunch. And as I mentioned, they had a vizier that helped them to go through some very famineous, horrible times that they had at the beginning of their reign. Panhasi was his name. And we find in the Bible such a person with a name very similar to that. Let's see if I put that down too. I hope so, because I can't remember it. Yes, we remember Joseph, son of Jacob, who was in Egypt, taken there. We know the story, how he was raised up to be the vizier, or the second in the kingdom. And he was known, according to the Bible, as Zaphnath Paneah. Paneah, Panazi. We've got a very similar Egyptian name there, Zaphnath. And of course, the scripture tells us that he married the priestess of the... Damn it. I gotta turn that off. The priestess of the god On, O-N. The priestess of the god of the underworld, whose name was Asenath. We read in scripture. So Joseph has the name Zaphnath. It gives us another clue here. Zaphnath Paneah is none other than the vizier Panazi of the monotheistic king, strange king, the heretical king, Akhenaten, servant of the Aten. Again, the Aten being the sun, or the god that the sun represented, the one that we might call El Elyon, the most high El. Let me read a little to you. From Robert Feather. Quite often when you're introduced to someone, you can get a good idea of their age from their first name and even the place of their birth. Parents tend to choose names that are popular at the time of their offspring's birth, and certain names that were fashionable, say, in the 1920s, are simply no longer in vogue. Hey, my name was not in vogue when I got it. It's in vogue now. When I'm in the grocery store, Invariably, I will hear some mother or father calling out, Jackson, Jackson, stay out of that. It's popular now. I always look around and wonder if they're talking to me and if I'm going to have to fight somebody. The etymology of personal names used in the Joseph story is extremely instructive when viewed from this perspective. It gives us a chronological horizon that fits neatly into the likelihood that those he interacted with were contemporary with the Egyptian 18th dynasty. We find Potiphar, Joseph's master, Asenath, Joseph's wife, Potipharah, Joseph's father-in-law, Zaphnath Paneah, the Egyptian name given to Joseph by Pharaoh. We find these in Genesis 39-41. This last name doesn't obviously conform to the pattern of Egyptian names of that period, but as analyzed in chapter 5, it's almost certainly the Hebrew version of an Egyptian hieroglyph relating to Amenhophis, the son of Hapu. The others are clearly Egyptian. After Joseph's betrayal by Potiphar's wife, he was incarcerated in prison. And we have another series of dream interpretations which are said to turn out to be accurate. Is there any possible external confirmation of this story and the date of the dream? The answer is qualified. Yes. The suffix Ra, R-A-H, is seen as connecting Potiphar's name to the ancient temple city of On, which also happens to be modern Heliopolis, where that later Onian temple of Yahweh was set up in about 170 BC. Of course, that's 1,000 years later than what we're talking about now. Potipharah is said to have been a priest at this religious center by the time Amenhotep III and Akhenaten, that is Amenhotep IV, and had been converted into a temple for the new pharaoh's religious... Hello? Pharaoh's religion and the pagan imagery destroyed. It's not surprising that the name of On is revered in Judean tradition, and the Hebrew name for On is a vocalization for the Egyptian Yono, often pronounced as Yono, Tsiono, Tsiono, Tsion, Zion. On, as Zion, is remembered in Hebrew's prayers. Even today, the name of Jerusalem is coupled with the name of Zion, that's Zion, in Jewish prayers, but it's clear that they are two separate places. The name Asenath has long been thought of as deriving from the Egyptian name Ansnut, she who belongs to the goddess Neith. But Professor Kenneth Kitchen has rejected this interpretation. He says, in a forthcoming book, I will provide evidence that suggests a definite connection of the goddess Neith and that the name is tied firmly to the role of the high priest at Akhenaten's temple, so that the original link may well be correct. Joseph's name is given as Zaphnath Paneah. He's been the subject of much debate as to the meaning. Kenneth Kitchen, I believe, comes up with a likely explanation in the view of its link to Akhenaten's reign, although that of Joseph Davidovitz is more compelling. Kitchen postulates the name as which means Joseph, who is called Ip-Ankh. Ankh, of course, means life. He who recognizes life. The significance of this interpretation is that the Ankh reached its peak of employment as a religious motif and can be seen as a key element in the Amarna period, with the Ankh sign attached to the end of the life-enhancing rays in the symbology of the Aten. So the artwork there, you see a lot of sun disks, and coming from those sun disks are always golden rays that go down toward the people below. And in fact, at the end of that ray, there's an Ankh sign. Of course, it means life. It's not a pagan symbol unless you make it that. It's a picture of a cross with a aperture in the upper top of it.
You know what an Ankh is?
Yeah, you had one on the other night. You didn't know that. You didn't wear it. Okay. Some Egyptologists like Donald Redford and Alan Shulman date these names to the 21st or 22nd dynasties, but Kenneth Kitchen places them at an earlier time and concludes that the transition to the form seen in the Bible began to start of the 18th dynasty. Thus, the names recorded by the Bible for Joseph are entirely consistent with the probable dates and location of Joseph and his family that I have suggested, the 14th century BC and the Holy City of Akhetaten in Middle Egypt. Now, I said this was at Amarna. That's what they call it now. But Akhenaten named his new city and temple Akhetaten. How about that? Akhenaten from Akhetaten. It almost sounds like a limerick. There once was a man, Akhenaten. He came from a place, Akhetaten. I just can almost see what the end of that's going to be. A study of the Elephantine papyri, written by members of an Aramaic-speaking pseudo-Jewish group that lived on the island of Yeb in southern Egypt, shows that similar name patterns to those used in the 18th dynasty occur in the recording of Semitic birth names and given Egyptian names. This is not too surprising. My contention, says Feather, is that the settlers on Yeb Island, that is Elephantine, and that was a place that was full of Hebrews, who were there for hundreds of years before 400 BC, were originally refugees from Akhetaten, with all that implies. And what it implies is that, as I mentioned, after some years after Akhetaten was, you'll never get up there that way. You need the step stool. Right there's a step stool. You will die a horrible death. There you go. The Hebrews were part of the conversion of the Egyptian kingship to monotheistic religion. We find in the Old Testament and the prophets almost constant reference to the sun as an icon or a stand-in for the great El Elyon, the Most High Elohim. It comes from Egypt. We've got Adonai, which comes from Egypt, speaking of the sun, again, as not as a god, but as a representation of a god that has many rays, and at the end of each ray that terminates in a person is the symbol of life. We've got the name Joseph, or Panhasi and Panea. How could they be much different? We've got Asenath in both places, the wife of Joseph, the priestess of On, who obviously was converted over to this religion because all temples of On were destroyed. What else do we have? We have in Ezekiel and the temple scroll a perfect layout found in Akhetaten or Amarna for a gigantic temple there, bigger than the whole of Jerusalem, bigger than the whole city. You can't fit that temple into Jerusalem, and it will never be seen in Jerusalem. So those looking for a third temple being built in Jerusalem, they're never going to see that temple. It's too big to fit in the city. But it's not too big to be rebuilt in Amarna or Akhetaten, the place of the Aten.
You are experiencing Jackson Snyder Presents on Hebrew Nation Radio. It's time to take a little break, and we'll be right back after the following interruptions. Jackson Snyder Presents is back, just as we promised.
There's too many similarities here. We find two places of refuge for Hebrews. When Akhetaten was done, the Hebrews had to leave fast. Some of them went to Elephantine Island, and there they set up another temple unto Yahweh. The others went south down to, down to Alphae, the place of the Hebrew priesthood. The Alphae priesthood is mentioned in the New Testament. Remember, you've got James, son of Alphaeus. You've got Matthew, son of Alphaeus. In the original text, there's no son of in there. It's talking about James or Yaakov and Matityahu, the Alphae. The Alphae were the descendants of the priests of northern Sudan, a tribe made up of Hebrews that had left Akhetaten in time not to be getting down below the border, not to be persecuted and killed, but rather to find there a priesthood that not only healed the sick, but also prayed rain in, prayed storms done, and had a great deal of power in the area of dominating and ruling the people there of the Sudan place. And the Egyptians couldn't touch them. They were over the border. Lots of things going on in Egypt. But was Panasi, the biblical Joseph, Panasi's titles as superintendent of the oxen of the Aten, superintendent of the granary of the Aten. They certainly accord with the role of Joseph in the Hebrew Bible. That's exactly what the Bible says he did, that he was able to store the grain in such a way as to keep famine off for 7 years. As vizier, the Bible says he was second only to the Pharaoh and put in charge of coping with the impending 7-year famine he had predicted. He doesn't appear to have had his formal title of vizier, but the name of Panhasi is attested as vizier under Pharaoh Merenptah. When asked to wonder if Panhasi was not in fact the biblical Joseph, I believe it was. What other reason would there be for an emperor, for a king of Egypt to be raised up and change the entire religion of the country from the worship of spirits of the giants, that is, half-human, half-animal gods, to the one El Elyon, the great one, iconized as the sun? See what else here. All right, so what we're finding with Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, with a third temple written up in sacred scrolls of the Essenes. Remember, the rabbinicals, the Pharisees were not allowed to read Ezekiel. That wasn't their book. That was the Zadokite book of prophecy written by a Zadokite priest whose name was Ezekiel. And of course, the temple scroll, all having diagrams. I'm thinking diagrams because I just got a diagram of a new idea for the tabernacle, which maybe we'll talk about here next time. But written plans for a gigantic, gigantic temple that had already existed, some thousand years before. That's all pretty exciting. It's exciting because why we think paganism was the origin of the Hebrew religion? No, not at all. Just the opposite. We're finding an origin of the Hebrew religion that allows it to fan out to a greater number of people. And not only that, but we see the faith as a conquering of the actual entire country of Egypt for a certain amount of time. And certainly as the Hebrews fled from Akhetaten and fled northward to Elephantine and then up to Heliopolis, we read of their experiences in Heliopolis, that is Cairo, throughout the books of the Maccabees, especially 3rd Maccabees, which is all about the Hebrews in exile in Alexandria, also known as Cairo, Egypt, and I wonder how they got there. And in the times of Yeshua, of course, there were more Hebrews, more Jews in Egypt than there were in Israel, because Egypt was packed with them. In fact, they even had their own temple there from the destruction of the Zadokites in Jerusalem. A son of the high priest who was assassinated in 175, that is Onias III, was able to get out of Dodge and go over and build a new temple unto Yahweh in Ptolemy's Egypt. He was glad to pay for it. And Onias, the son of the priest, Onias IV, was able actually to build an entire recreation of Jerusalem there in Heliopolis along with the temple. But this is all about Rachel Elior, right? The reason I even bring this up is when you deal with the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have to find origins. Too many people want to try to find origins of the Dead Sea Scrolls in Nazarene Israel in rabbinic lore or in the movement of the Pharisees. But the Pharisees were the desperate enemies of the movement of Essenes and also of Nazarene. So we are not going to have to look to rabbinic Judaism. That's not going to work. We got to look before that. So we're going to go over to Rachel Elior now. I'm putting some things together here. And this is in a chapter in her book, The Three Temples. Oh, they definitely use hallucinogens. Of course they did. That's why making the incense was illegal. The incense has cannabis in it. Is there something wrong with that? Well, that's a question that is much debated, or was anyway, in the Yihad. What about the use of substances in worship that alter the mind? I've been in plenty of charismatic worship sessions where definitely the minds were altered, but not with false drugs. Right. Come on over.
I've been reading this Kabbalah book, and it was saying that people were bypassing all the disciplines that it would take to enter into the prophetic state that a lot of the prophets were into. They would use the hallucinogenic drugs in order to bypass all the disciplines and become in a prophetic state. The problem with that was it allowed evil spirits to come in because they didn't have the discipline of the training that the prophets had had. So they bypassed all that, and that's a lot of why the Kabbalah people, went underground and they hid all of their teachings on how to attain the prophetic state. And they speak much of this, but they say that people bypassed it by hallucinogenic drugs and try to attain that state.
Thank you. Well, around here, we're high on the real thing. Powerful gasoline, clean windshield, and a shoe shine. Hebrew shamanism. Now, this is something that would be worth talking to. And Dawid Ben Israel, I think he's having connection problems over there. He's been on and off several times. He is investigating that right now. He's actively investigating the idea of shamanism, not only Hebrew shamanism, but shamanism as an aid to worship, as an aid to health. I know that sounds a little bit out of our realm of holiness, but in the Yihad, if you've got an inkling to do that kind of research, who's here to stop them? What do we do? Do we write an injunction, or do we do...
No.
What do we do? What do we do with somebody like that that wants to investigate shamanism? Shouldn't we punish him?
Your term investigate depends upon what your term is to investigate. If you're investigating it to enter into it and how shall I say it? Evoke the spirits that these shamanistic spirits are letting in, then yes, if you're investigating it from Hebrew shamanism. Some people will say that would be the Kabbalists. But if you do it from an academic standpoint and keep your faith intact, you can learn about it. However, do not enter into it. When I believe Solomon, when he had ability to have wisdom all over the world to understand it. It wasn't until he actually allowed his many wives and their beliefs to come into his heart, in a sense, so that he actually entered into it in his person, in his spirit. That would be the limit. That would be a point of, in a sense, no return when you're evoking spirits, a strange fire. I guess that's how we would explain it, would be bringing strange fire before Yahweh. And that's where it would be crossing the line and something needs to be done about it. But investigating it from an academic point of view.
Good explanation. There is on our audio site, jspresents.org, right now, an hour-long presentation by our brother Ben Israel. It's called Amazonian Pharmacopoeia. He's been investigating plants in the Amazon for quite some time, and he believes that there is a strong possibility that one particular type of plant, yes, that's it, ayahuasca. He is planning a trip to Peru, right? To Peru to go down and investigate further. He lives in Honduras, as you know. And if you come over here for our boot camp in January, he'll be here to report to you in person on this particular topic. But what do we do? And if you're in church and you made that known, you would be thrown out for sure. Hebrew. If you're in a Hebrew roots movement, same thing. Here, we listen. If you have an idea for research, especially if you've achieved some esteem in your walk, then please go do it. I think I would be put off a little by the term shamanism. I suggested to David that we use a different term, that we might use primitive philosophers. How is that?
Primitive mystic?
Yeah.
This is not a bad word.
No, mystics is a good word. This is what Josephus used for Essenes and mystics. He called them philosophers so that the Greeks speaking, his Greek readers would think of Greek philosophy. I don't know. I've got Elior here. She's talking about mysticism for sure, and I'm kind of debating on what to read. I really want to read a lot of it. I want to read the first part of the Three Temples, but I'm going to skip that first part, and I'm just going to get into the mystical origin of the calendar, because I know everybody's interested in the Zadokite calendar. And when you ask, somebody asked me today, I don't know if it's here or not, when does the day start? Well, for us, the day starts when the sun comes up. Now, that's a funny thing. When the Aten makes its appearance and we see the rays of the Aten, that is the time that day starts. And when the Aten's gone, then the day is over. Are there not 12 hours in a day, somebody said. If you know anything about morphic resonance, it's going to resonate with you in what Rachel Elior's brain slice has to say. Sacred heavenly space exhibits a vertical sevenfold pattern. This is almost exactly what is in the theory of morphic resonance. What are the morphic forms made of? They're made of space-time. They're made of space-time. What are morphic fields? Go look it up. Sacred heavenly space exhibits a vertical sevenfold pattern. It's divided in the songs of the Sabbath sacrifice into seven lofty holy places, seven wondrous territories, seven holy mysteries, seven most holy precincts, seven devarim of the priesthoods, seven holy precincts, I said that one, or into seven hechelot in seven firmaments. Hechel, that's a temple, Hechelot temples. But it also displays a fourfold pattern, exemplified by the four sides of the chariot throne, that is the Merkavah. The four points of the compass, four foundations of the wondrous firmament. In parallel to these spatial patterns, the secessionist priests, those were the Zadokites she's talking about, secessionists, they observed and preserved a fixed, eternal, and continuous cyclic sevenfold pattern of sacred time divided into four equal seasons. They regarded the cultic calendar, don't think of cultic as a cult, you know, cultic, it just means the religious or sacred calendar, that governed the sacred temple services around the time of their secession, based on a lunar calendar of 354 days, counted in months of unequal length, depending on the human discretion, based on variable human observations of the new moon, as false and arbitrary, an infringement of the covenant, sinful and wicked. This newly imposed lunar calendar was to be replaced by the ancient priestly solar calendar, reestablishing the sacred ritual and liturgical calendar of the divine origin, extant from the very beginning of time, characterized by a fixed, eternal, cosmic sevenfold and fourfold symmetry, counting in Shabbats of days, that is weeks, and cycles of annual seasons. The sacred divisions of the solar calendar are outlined by the Angel of the Countenance, speaking to Moses in the Jubilees. And I quote, "And all of the weeks which will be commanded will be 52 weeks of days, and all of them are a complete year. Thus it is engraved and ordained on the heavenly tablets. And you command the children of Israel so that they shall guard the years in this number, 364 days, and it will be a complete year, and no one shall corrupt its appointed time from its days and from its feasts." So this system was based on a solar calendar of 364 days, consisting of 52 weeks, whose Sabbaths were counted in a fixed annual cycle, divided symmetrically among the four annual seasons, and on a prescribed mathematical calculation of the progress of the solar year, 12 30-day months, with four further days added to differentiate the four annual seasons. These 364 days were divided into four quarters or seasons, each of 13 14 weeks, which altogether constituted a year of 52 Sabbaths. Hold on a minute. The principles of the beautiful, harmonic, mathematical calculation underlying the solar year, which according to priestly tradition derive from a divine origin, are enunciated in detail in these places. 1 Enoch 72, 74, 75, 82, 2 Enoch 13 through 17, 41 through 48, the Book of Jubilees 6, 4 QMMT, that is the Masa Al Torah, the sum of the works of the Torah, the Psalm Scroll 11 QPS 27. Mentions of these principles may also be found in the Temple Scroll, the Damascus Document, the Scroll of Priestly Courses, the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice. The solar year began on the day on which the heavenly luminaries were created. What day was that? That's your quiz. On what day were the heavenly luminaries created? Think about it. You have 5 seconds to answer. That's correct. What day, according to our pagan system? What's the name of the day? Come on, Duane, what's the name of the fourth day? That's right, Wednesday. The solar year began on the day on which the heavenly luminaries were created. Wednesday. And was divided into consecutive quarters of fixed structure, 91 days divided into 13 weeks. The Sabbath fell on fixed days. The days on which the first days of the month and the festivals fell were also known in advance, always falling on the same day of the week, the festivals on the same day of the month, and in the same position within the quarter. No festival could ever fall on a Sabbath. And neither could the first day of any month. The solar calendar could be used to determine the cycles of service of the 24 priestly courses in sevenfold cycles of sabbatical years and jubilees. This calendar, ordained and written in the heavenly tablets and imprinted on the cyclic laws of nature, divided into seasons and signs of the zodiac based on an underlying fourfold annual principle, reflects the divine pattern of time. Then what we have in this juncture in the book is a chart of the 364 days. The sevenfold solar year measuring time on the basis of a sacred principle, amalgamating the cosmic astronomical order and the ritual and liturgical order, was first learned from its guardians. So she's telling us where it came from. That is, the angels in heaven, who taught it to men in the time of Enoch, the seventh patriarch of the world, who in turn taught it to his descendants, the priests Methuselah, Lamech, and Noach, and we read it in the books of Enoch. What pages in Three Temples are you reading from? We're right now on page 48. You have Three Temples? Oh, you do? I learned something in here. Duane, I skipped over something. I didn't read because it came as a shock to me. It's secret knowledge, and only you can have that knowledge because you now have the book. And I gave you a hint that I skipped over something very important. When I read it, I was horrified. I couldn't say it out loud. You can see me wiping my eyes with these baby wipes.
But out of the shroom cough, I've been editing this session, and I happened to go look up to see what Brother Snyder left off. And I'm telling you, it's a bombshell. He's been teaching something evidently wrong. Either he's wrong or Raquel Elior is wrong. One of the two, I would probably bet on Brother Snyder being wrong. And I say this is a very, very important matter to skip over. But I'm not going to tell you what that is. I know he never listened to this again, so he won't know that I know, but I can tease him about it. I certainly will, because it is a bombshell. Change everything about calendar. It really does. But I guess you'll have to get book, or maybe you send me $10, a couple box top off cereal box, and I tell you, yes, I will go ahead because I have to have a second job too, you know. I can't live forever at this age on Social Security. You see, I went on Social Security 45 years ago. So I have to get a second job, and I've been thinking about checking out Brother Snyder work, as I always do, and selling secrets, okay? You can really put it over on him, and lots of people right now using Zedekite calendar. If you want to pay me $10 and send me box top, or, of course, you can pay $30 and you can wade through that great big book and have of it in Hebrew and try to figure out yourself. But I would advise you to pick the easy way, Brother Shrumkoff. My address is 9611 North U.S. Highway 1, Sebastian, Florida, 32958. You put box 157 on there someplace. Yes, I'm expecting my mailbox to be full of $10 bill starting just a few days. So now, if you don't get that address down, I'm telling you, go to jspresents.org and look up this particular recording. Get my address, and I'm going to tell you a secret that I hope there's nothing sinful about what I'm doing. I don't think so, but I think some precious angel give me a new way to make money. Finally, see not too many modeling job coming in these days from agency. And beside, you send me, when I send back secret, I'll send you a little gift as well, a nice little souvenir from Moldova. What is souvenir? Oh, listen, I come back with those Moldova cockroach all over everything. I send you one so you can grow your own right there where you live in Kansas.
So, you think I don't listen to these, huh? Shrumkoff, you're fired. Pack up your stuff and leave right now.
I want to go to 61 if you have the book. I don't want you to know, Barbie, but it's something I've been wondering about for a long time and could never get a straight answer about, but I just got one in the book. Well, if you want to spend $30 or $40, this is an expensive book. I borrowed it from the library. Look, if you've got some extra money, you could send me one. I'm going to page 61 real quick, and then we'll close it off here in a little bit. Yes, you can borrow it. The circles among whom Proto-Qumran and Qumran literature was composed, edited, preserved, and ultimately canonized, proposed to replace the temple cult of their time with three central priestly mystical traditions. This is going to be on the final exam. Number one, the Merkava. Have you ever heard of the Merkava tank that destroyed Syria in that last war? It's a chariot of fire. The Merkava, chariot throne of the cherubim, and the Devir, or Holy of Holies, of the desert sanctuary, and of Solomon's temple, built according to the heavenly prototype, and Ezekiel's Merkava, its visionary transformation as prototypes of the sacred heavenly space. And I might add, when we look at the Ark of the Covenant with the cherubim, we've got the wings that touch there. And we've got between it the mercy seat. Now that mercy seat was considered to be the seat upon which the pilot of the Merkava sat. And the cherubim were in there as engines and wings. And the Ark of the Covenant was the body of the Merkava. So really, what she's saying that Ezekiel saw when he saw a wheel within a wheel within a wheel, Ezekiel saw the wheel. It was a great old wheel. What he saw was arcs that were chariots of fire flying through the sky. Arcs of the covenant with a little man on the mercy seat there and these big cherubim of gold on the side set ablaze and flying through the sky. Their wings were always parallel. They turned together. They turned together in the vision of Ezekiel chapter 1, 2, and 3. Why wouldn't the Pharisees want anyone to know about that? Well, what we didn't know, thinking it was UFOs, we could look and see now. We got some people that have figured it out from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So we have the chariot throne, and the second priestly mystical tradition is the calendar of Sabbaths. Solar calendar is revealed in the tradition of Enoch, Jubilees, the Qumranic Psalms of David, which it says there are like 4,030 Psalms altogether, preserved in the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, in the Temple Scroll, in the calendars of priestly courses, in the MMT, and the prototype of sacred heavenly time. And the third priestly mystical tradition is the angelic priesthood. Now, have we ever heard of this before? Were angels, were Malachim, powers, aeons, served
as priests?